when I have any occasion at all up here this summer to talk about virtually anything, I push my secular version of the current Bible, which is what's called Habits of the Heart, Individualism and Commitment in American Life. It's been out for a little over a year now by Bob Bella from the University of California and a group of his colleagues, three other men and a woman. How many of you know the book Habits of the Heart? Are you acquainted with it at all? A lot. Some of us, I think that it's probably the most significant examination of the American character to appear probably in the last 25 years. I don't know if you agree with that, Chuck.
I thought you were going to say 150 years.
25.
They go back to de Tocqueville all the time.
Tocqueville is,
which is 150 years ago.
But there are some interesting books in the 50s about the American character, but I don't think we've had anything this good in about 30 years about who we are as Americans and what our dilemmas are and what really goes on inside us and what that has to do with what goes on outside of us. So whenever I get a chance this summer, I'm holding this up, Habits of the Heart, Bob Bella et al. They deal with character and morals, and one of the themes that runs throughout the book here about us Americans and about particularly our religious life but also our civic life is the tension between what they call private morality and public morality. And in particular, the difficulty that American people have, particularly in the 20th century, expressing a public morality, finding a way to do that, finding the language even to begin to do that. They talk a lot about the ways in which we've developed languages of individualism. And one of the places we've done that is in our churches. And they talk about the tension between private morality and public morality in our churches. At the end of a very thought-provoking chapter on religion in American life, they point, though, toward the significant kind of heritage we have as American Christians of social involvement. We've pointed out in previous chapters how often in our history religion has played an important role in significant social movements. Time and again, spiritually motivated individuals and groups, right, Bella, have felt called to show forth in their lives the faith that was in them by taking a stand on the great ethical and political issues of the day. During the American Revolution, the parish clergy gave ideological support and moral encouragement to the Republican cause. Christian clergy and laity were among the most fervent supporters of the anti-slavery cause, just as Christians involved in the social gospel movement and its many ramifications did much to ameliorate the worst excesses of early industrial capitalism. Of course, the churches produced opponents of all these movements. The American religious community has never spoken with one voice. On occasion, a significant part of the religious community has mounted a successful crusade that the nation as a whole later felt that came to feel was unwise. For example, the temperance movement that led to a constitutional amendment prohibiting the sale of alcoholic beverage in the U.S. But without the intervention of the churches, many significant issues would have been ignored and needed changes would have come about much more slowly. They come to believe, Bella and his cohorts, in Habits of the Heart, that in fact, the religious life of America is one of the major sources for the potential reconstruction of a public arena for American life. And that's kind of part of what we want to talk about tonight. We're lucky to have Chuck here to lead us into this discussion a little bit in his seat in Minneapolis at the Office of Church and Society for the ALC. Chuck gets a chance to look at congregations across the country. And like anybody who looks at a lot of similar things, he begins to construct typologies when he sees patterns emerging. So I think what you have consented to do is to tell us what you've been seeing in terms of the different forms that social involvement take in the congregation. And then let's talk about it and see where folks here are.
Okay, Jody, I've got a very simple analysis, which is a three-part typology of what I see happening typically in congregations in the area of what we might call broadly social ministry or social engagement. First of all, for a lot of Lutheran congregations in this country, including those I grew up in rural northern Iowa, German-American Lutheranism, we hardly dealt with the social agenda at all. That has changed, I think, substantially since World War II, and probably more particularly since the 60s. there has been engagement increasingly by Lutherans in this country at the parish expression with the civil rights movement, with the Vietnam War, with the changing roles of women and men, that issue, feminism, and so on. What I think we are most marked by these days is social study. That is, we, in almost every congregation that I have any contact with or any awareness of, there is some kind of study of social issues going on. Adult forums on Sunday morning, very typically these days. Other kinds of things. There may be social ministry committees formed that study issues. Sometimes church councils get involved with that. So I think this has become sort of legitimated in the last couple of decades. It's okay to do that, to do social education in the parish. It's even okay for the pastor occasionally in a sermon to get into social questions, as long as he doesn't get too political. And we may want to talk about that some a little tonight. What is the role, the appropriate role of the pastor as you see it? A second area that Lutherans have, in some respects, been very big in for a long time is social service. We have developed a network of social service agencies, primarily outside the congregation. That is, congregations create and support in various ways these social service agencies, but we now have a lot of professional people who do that for us. But to some extent, we also do this in congregations. And social service, I understand, to be almost one-on-one or dealing with individuals rather than whole systems in the society, and almost bandaging up the victims, that kind of ministry, dealing with people who are hurting right now and need care. Lutherans are very good at that. In this country, we have, proportionate to our size, by far the largest network and the largest investment in staff and money in social service work. We're quite good at that. Catholics would be up there with us, although proportionate to size, I think Lutherans are doing more than Roman Catholics. Well, you know the social service agencies, statewide agencies, Lutheran Social Service of Arizona, of California, etc. That kind of thing, and then all sorts of specialized agencies. But I'll come back to that in terms of what I see typically congregations doing in that area. Social change, the third element of the triad, or the wholeness of the circle, we aren't very good at. That deals with systems, that deals with changing, that deals with reforming, with action, with social action. And I think that is a little bit more scary to us because that's political. That is always political. That is always challenging the status quo and saying it ought to be better, it ought to be different, it ought to be more just, it ought to be revised, reformed. So I think we are fairly comfortable now with studying issues. For a long time we've been doing this, and we still do quite a bit of that, even in congregations, not only in the agencies that they've spawned, but we're very reluctant to get into this, with, I think, good reason. This is more frightening, it's more threatening, it's obviously more political. Now let me just give you an example, running through all of this, of what I mean to put some flesh on it. The issue of refugees in the world. Lutherans, along with other Christians in this country, the churches have been the primary vehicle for resettling refugees, whether from Southeast Asia or earlier from Uganda or from any number of places after World War II, more recently from Ethiopia, from Namibia to some degree, and from Central America. Typically, a congregation will hear about a need and they'll take a look at it. Maybe they'll establish a committee to study it and come up with a recommendation. That's what my congregation did some 6-7 years ago. And we decided out of that study to recommend to the congregation that we embark on it. We had not been involved in it before, but we have, since that study, actually gotten into resettling some Ethiopians in the Twin Cities. I would call that social service. That's kind of one-on-one response to immediate need. And we know how to do that well and fairly comfortable with it. What would the social change dimension of it be? I think the social change dimension of refugee work is to challenge, if that's what seems to be needed, U.S. policy, U.S. immigration policy. To ask basic questions about why refugees are being produced all over the world anyway, and what is the role of our nation in that, for good or ill. That might get you into, with Central Americans, some things that are viewed very questionably by our government.
sanctuary movement. Might be challenging, actually, the understanding of our government of who's legal here and who isn't. That would be social change or social action. It would involve advocacy for legislative reform, or to take the issue of hunger. A lot of congregations have studied hunger. A lot of them have responded in various ways, both domestically and internationally, with money, in other ways, trying to be involved in social service. Social change in that area would probably involve some legislative action, some advocacy work, some public policy work, some political work. Now, my theory is that for a lot of congregations, there is the feeling that if we've studied an issue, we've done that issue, and then we can move on to something else. When I was working with the hunger program of our church some years ago, we would regularly get inquiries from congregations, what's the issue this year? We've already done hunger. And that's the way they talked about it. We've done hunger. It's like, let's do lunch together sometime. But we've done hunger. I don't want to demean that. I think study and getting understanding of the issue is very important. But I think it's not complete if we stop with study only, if we don't move into action. Well, the easiest way to get into action is with social service. But in my judgment, we also need to try always to move into the social reform, social change aspects of whatever issue we're working with, too, even though that's much more difficult.
Okay. Let me just briefly add a fourth that has seemed important to me. As Chuck and I were talking today about this. Most of my work with congregations is with congregations in poor communities in cities. And they certainly also are involved in all of those areas. But we've begun to think about a fourth way.
Yeah, I would say, and I should have said, this is a typical middle class congregational response. And you're going to talk about something a little different from
just,
that.
Just yeah. Really briefly to lay out one other possibility, at least in poor communities. We have a number of us who've been involved in changing some stuff in cities, or at least being interested in doing that, have come to think that there are some real downsides to the social service model as it applies to poor communities. That is, the same kind of critiques that, in fact, Reagan makes of the social service model, that it creates some dependency, that it defines communities as poor communities especially, and people of color kinds of communities, as places where there are bundles and bundles of needs. Bundles and bundles of deficiencies, that all those areas are areas where there are problems. So that as we have worked in those areas through the years, it's become more and more important for us to self-consciously and with the folk begin to define those areas in terms not of their needs but of their capacities. And that's led us in our work with congregations in those areas to think about an area that I would probably call social development, that is, at least in poor communities. Where you start not with a needs assessment, like all the foundations and social service agencies do, but you start with perhaps a capacity assessment. That is, you look around the neighborhood and you figure out what the capacities are in the folks. You look in the poor congregation and you figure out what the abilities are there. And you build on those capacities and abilities. You build on those in a way that tells people you're not just a bundle of needs. You're not just a bundle of deficiencies. Too often it has seemed to us that the social service model has defined those kinds of folks out in a way that denudes them of any capacity. So at least in poor communities, I would argue for a fourth category, the
could,
social
could
development.
Be called empowerment.
Empowerment.
Empowerment?
Sure. It's exciting to find in a poor black community in the West Side 25 women who sew. Who have never thought about sewing as a capacity that could build something, who are now part of a thriving sewing cooperative.
For economic development.
They now have jobs, 25 jobs mm-hmm. there, and more and more contracts coming in. So that sort of building, I think, from the bottom up is what we're interested in doing in poor congregations, in poor neighborhoods. So there are four things. I think one of the things we'd like to do is hear from the rest of you where you are. In terms of the way in which your congregations deal with social involvements, the reluctances and fears that we all have to get into it.
What works and what doesn't work. What mobilizes a congregation and what divides a congregation. Because I think in this area, one of the realities is that congregations can easily be divided, especially when you get into the third category of the political.
Do you see that kind of development as something that a middle class congregation could in any way do? I mean, I suppose they'd have to be close to an area where it was needed. Is that?
I haven't worked with middle class congregations on this way of thinking about things. I think off the top of my head, I think some of it's probably transferable. Sometimes it seems to me that our church talk is too much about needs and incapacities and emptinesses and not enough about resources and capacities and skills and stuff that we've really got to give.
Does that lead folks into themselves taking social action or working for political and social change? Is that part of the empowerment and development?
Could be. I mean, one of the reluctances to get into social change is that people feel like they can't affect anything.
Yeah.
You can't fight City Hall. You can't fight U.S. policy. How in the world can you be effective?
So let's just keep on bandaging up the victims as we are able.
Yeah.
That's an understandable response, I think, when you're dealing with complicated systems that need to be changed. Back here.
In our church, we have an office of governmental affairs out of New York or Philadelphia, whichever.
In Washington.
Okay, wherever.
You mean the one that deals with federal?
Chuck Bergstrom.
Chuck Bergstrom is director of that office.
Back there somewhere.
Yeah. And he works for the three uniting Lutheran bodies. That office serves all three that are planning a merger.
We have 19 states and who have advocacy coordinators for their states.
For state government,
congregations. I served on the Washington Policy Board before I came to Poland. And there's ongoing training for congregational network coordinators. And really, been doing well.
Yep.
Washington is one of the 19 states that have that, and they're trying to expand that, of course. I think the ALC has been invited, and some congregations in the ALC now are part of that in Washington State.
Yeah, this is primarily an LCA development, you're right, and in some states the ALC contributes and supports, and ALC congregations are involved, in some states not.
Right. But it's a wonderful way to get congregations involved and give them some training so they feel a little bit empowered and teach them how to go about it. And we had annual meetings in Olympia, and we went through the state capitol, and people even got comfortable talking with legislators. It's really neat.
The director of it here, I think, is Nancy Carlson.
Right,
isn't that her name?
Washington,
yeah.
Right.
In this state.
Mm-hmm. Who happens to be a member of ALC. So.
We have a right to read in Olympia, too, that Elsie Backlund has started. And we are trying to get some of these adults that are illiterate reading and carrying them up, and then members of our church are learning, trained in it so that they can do that. And I think that's helping, trying to empower people that would move in any other way. I think another thing that we did that was interesting is that the Sidoras in our church changed our social group to call it SOACT, S-O-A-C-T. And instead of studying it all the time, we're going to act on it. And so they pick three or four areas each year that we're going to act on. And then those
give some examples. Easily. What kinds of concerns?
Well, one of them is latchkey. We have all these parents with kids going home to empty houses and helping to support the organization that takes care of these kids after school and before school. And the Lutheran Church women then have decided that over two-thirds of their fundraising would go to support this, which is right now on a very slim. As soon as Reagan started cutting, that it was nice that our church is now coming and filling in some of the gaps, about $2,000 a year for that. We've worked with the Safe Place for battered women, and we have worked with the co-op child care service in helping giving crayons, scissors, and things like that. We have three things that we cut out and put into the bulletin three times a year. One's an angel. And that's for prisoners. We give gifts at Christmas to fathers' kids that are in prison. And we sign it to that father's number. And it's not our name. And then these gifts are all sent to these families so the children get gifts from their fathers. In the fall, we have leaves, and they have whatever we want people to bring. They bring in the next Sunday, and the narthex is just full of all these things. And then at Easter, then we had a cross that had the same type of thing. Or even though we had an Easter egg, find an Easter egg, take this Easter egg home, find these things, and then bring them back. It's filled as the narthex with all these.
Do they get involved at all with taking on City Hall?
No, but I want to, and I'm going to find out from her. I think it's horrible. I don't know about that. And also, I talked to a California lady about state Lutheran ministry right in the state capital, Sacramento. And she gave me the address, which I'm going to write to him.
Well, she's the same thing.
Same thing she's talking about. Yeah, these are state-level advocacy
efforts. I'll talk to
her tonight
and find out more about that. We have Associated Ministries in Olympia, too, which is all the churches and the whole community together. Working on a lot of needs in Olympia, which I'm real. Nancy Huff is a director of that. And we started Big Brothers and Big Sisters at our church, the little parsonage, and at their office now.
One of the interesting things about this discussion, and I think it does bear on your model, is that somehow we think about social service as something that everybody can do, right? Any congregation, any member of a congregation can be involved in a variety of needs meeting kinds of activity, but more and more, it seems to me anyway, that the social change kinds of operations are the realm relegated to the realm of the expert. I mean, we need...
So we push it beyond the congregation because, I think, because it's less threatening to do that. We ask the national church or the regional church or a state office in Olympia to do that for the congregations, but for congregations directly to be involved, that's kind of scary. Mm-hmm. At least that's my theory.
But that's the responsibility of those offices.
Yeah.
To respond back.
But how do we involve the people of the congregations more fully?
But in order to educate the people so that the people understand what processes they can be involved in to affect social change. Because the whole sense of I'm just one person in a whole group, a whole nation, I can't affect anything. That's one of the most major responsibilities is the exchange between those.
How many of you know the Bread for the World model?
Yeah.
How many of you are members of Bread for the World? Okay, some. Good. I think Bread for the World is working rather effectively in this area, but it's pretty non-threatening to congregations because individuals join Bread for the World if they want to, and individuals lobby collectively if they want to. Nobody compels them collectively to do anything. A congregation as such doesn't have to take a position on.
But there's the covenant congregation.
That's right. That's one more collective model for congregational involvement.
I'm curious about the state and national offices. Who sets policy for that, since it's hard to picture any political consensus coming out of our congregation?
Let's take a particular example from Washington State, if anyone here knows. What issues has that office worked on, and how was the policy base arrived at?
Child abuse is one.
Working for legislation in that area, right?
Right. Another one was right to know for migrant workers, for the insecticides, and things for picking and working with in the field. Oregon tackled the death penalty.
Yeah, I was thinking of that.
And again, a lot of congregations, that's their first question is, they have conservatives and they have liberals.
Who decides?
And they don't. They decide that, yes, this is something that is wrong. The method is an individual choice. How do we correct this, or how do we deal with it? And again, as in any congregation where there is anybody working on anything, there's only a few. There's not the whole congregation who comes to consensus to decide whether or not you're going to have dinner next Sunday. The women, or a little group of somebody, decides that. So no matter what's going on in a congregation, there's only a handful that's working on any one thing, and they don't represent necessarily the congregation, They go by the seat and decide they're going to tackle this as a church. It's a group of social activists who want to do it as Lutherans, as people.
And I think most people in congregations don't care, Gloria. If some want to get into that, that's their thing.
That's right.
Unless you claim to speak for the whole congregation, then people bristle.
Yeah,
and I think rightly so. The Oregon one I remember because a couple years ago, Oregon had a referendum to try to revive the death penalty. And the referendum, as I recall, was to ask the legislature, if the referendum passed, to ask the legislature to pass, to repass death penalty legislation. And that effort succeeded. But the churches organized to try to resist it, and they failed to stop it, but I think they still did some good educational work about the death penalty. Well, the Lutherans said, how can we get involved in this? And I think Cliff will remember some of this too, because they talked to the bishops of the region. And the LCA had an anti-death penalty statement, nationally, from 1968. The ALC did not have a position on the death penalty, still doesn't. So those two church bodies were in somewhat different situations. But I wonder if it was all that different, because even when a church body has a national statement on something, that doesn't mean necessarily the folks in the congregations agree with it or follow it. They say, well, so what? That doesn't speak for me. And Lutherans are marvelously independent at that point. Just because a national church statement has been adopted doesn't mean people will agree with it or follow it or lobby in that direction. But that's an important question in this whole area, I think. By what authority does the church collectively speak on any social question? If we had the Catholic model, Cliff, we could just, or used to be, we could just go with what the bishop said, and that would be
it. It does help when there's a national statement, though, when the national church has taken a stand. We had a resolution kind of affirming the sanctuary movement at our district convention. And I worked with the writers of the resolution to make sure they referred appropriately to the statement on
human law and the conscience
of
believers.
Law and the conscience of believers. And I think the very fact that we were able to tie it in with a position our church had already taken is what caused us to be able to pass that resolution as a district. And I think we would not have otherwise. So the national church can strengthen congregations or persons within congregations on those kinds of issues.
Yeah.
It's not just not local issues.
I think it's important to know I happened to be in the OGA in Washington right after Reagan bombed Libya. I called for that. There were a number of people that called the office Lutherans who were terribly concerned about what does the Lutheran Church have to say about such policy. And the response coming from that office is, we have no basis in our social statements to make any judgments as a Lutheran group. You as an individual are responsible to respond to that. Yeah. I think that's important for people to know that we're not going off half-cocked.
Yeah. And that was exactly right. That office was correct in saying that, because that office does not speak for the Lutheran bodies in this country until the Lutheran bodies in this country have told it to say something. When something like that comes along, there was no Lutheran position that the office could relay to people who inquired. Often the national bishops, on something that happens like that, and there's an immediate need for a response, the national Lutheran bishops will collectively speak, but they can't speak on every issue, and I don't think they should. But on Libya, that was one where they didn't say anything.
The last time they said something about one issue,
Yeah, regularly on South Africa and Namibia. The three Uniting Church bishops, Hertzfeld, Crumley, and Preuss, regularly will agree together to say something on an issue. And they did at the time of the sanctuary indictments in January of 85. They issued a statement of concern primarily about the infiltration of churches that had led to the gathering of evidence. I think all of the Uniting Church bishops, regional and national, said something jointly on the impact on the poor of the federal budget. Was that the fall of 85 or sometime in the last year or so? A lot of times those things are done, but they get very little press, very little attention, and our people don't really find out about them. But at least they're available when needed to draw on.
Did the Standard and the Lutheran magazine pick up on? I think the Lutheran magazine, LCA, has done a lot more trying to hit those issues. I'd love seeing the readers part of it, see what the reaction is in different parts of the United States. But don't you think that they, as magazines, can get more into this?
Yeah, I think they could. I think they could do a better job. Mm-hmm. Though I think they've done a fairly decent job in recent years of covering that, but whether that reaches the readers, I mean, the readers have to read it too. I'd be interested in pushing us back more into the congregation and what's happening in your congregations that that you'd like to talk about. It's either.
I'd like to.
Yeah.
Ed raised my hand, but he can't see me. I'm currently part of two congregations. I've got a home congregation in the Twin Cities area, and our church is right between two sets of apartment buildings for low-income families, and so after school, for elementary-age kids, we have a neighborhood program for those, so those kids have some place to go and something to do. There's a recently, probably 3 years ago, a food shelf established for our county, and our church makes an effort to keep that food shelf stocked. That's not a big major thing to do, but it's a very important thing to do, mm-hmm. and keeping it, and that's a very immediate need in our area. My college congregation, each fall and spring, will have what we call a fall fling or a spring fling, and we'll get students to volunteer Saturday morning or Saturday afternoon and go out and rake leaves or wash windows and change storm windows and that sort of thing for citizens in the community who can't do it for themselves. And we also have an adopt-a-grandparent program with the nursing home that's very close to our college. And students will be assigned a elderly person to be their grandparents. And that's what we're
doing.
Thank you.
I think I'm from British Columbia, so some of your ideas I'm not familiar with. We do have a common denominator in Lutheran World Mediques.
Yeah.
I'm on the mission board for BC, and we started two Chinese congregations in Vancouver, and both of them, one was a Hakka Lutheran who are loosely, I guess you could say, associated from Indonesia. They moved into Vancouver. They went and board $500,000 just like that to start up the congregation, and it is a strong congregation. Another group, started up just Chinese, and I don't even know how they got started, but they were looking for a minister, so they decided, well, since Lutheran World Relief has been helping some of their people, they came to Hong Kong and called a Lutheran pastor from Hong Kong. So some of the success stories we don't hear about.
Mm-hmm.
It just dumbfounded me that Lutheran World Relief was the timing for, and they're both strong. The one group, they've been going now for 2 years. They haven't had a pastor yet. They've got 185 families in there with 85 children in the Sunday school, and the reason you can't have more children because the children won't learn Chinese Sunday school. They only learn...
we have a visitor here.
They don't go to English Sunday school. They don't have enough English teachers for Sunday school. Just wonderful.
We've gone bi-national now, and I'm aware that there are Brazilians here too, and I wonder if they'd be interested in sharing with us some of the experience of the Lutheran Church in Brazil. How do congregations get involved with social justice concerns?
Well,
do you have any of the same?
I'm from the same church.
Do you have any of the same struggles that we have in North America with
sure.
that?
And I would say that we have this three-stage tool. And the same fear to go to social change.
But same fear.
Same fear, yeah.
I would like to know what involvement that the pastor of a middle-class congregation has with the poor people in the same town. Because in Brazil, in the Lutheran Church, most of the pastors, they are very conservative, and they stay in their place because the congregation is a middle-class congregation, and they think the pastor doesn't have anything to do with the poor people because
mm-hmm.
they are not Lutheran
mm-hmm.
or because they don't have money. And how is it here? Because it's a good excuse for the pastor and for the congregation to be separated from the separation.
I think probably not all that different here. A congregation has a very strong sense of what the pastor's job is, and it's to serve the congregation, not to maybe to reach out to bring other people into the congregation, including poor people, if the pastor can manage that. But basically, the congregation hires the pastor to serve them. I think that's
the
standard view. But I also think that we have a very large gap and a growing gap in this country in the social stance of pastors and people. And there's a wide margin in their views on a number of social issues. And that is itself a problem. And the pastors almost invariably are to the left, politically, of where their people are. As a group.
That's what I was going to say. I'm surprised we haven't heard yet tonight from pastors, for example, who would like to be more involved in this stuff in their congregations but are scared to or whatever. Because that's what I hear a lot is, and maybe it just means we have extremely active lay people here, which of course we have, but that it's that gap that I think is really tough. You come out of seminary generally really excited about peace issues, inclusive language, all kinds of issues, and then find the congregation uninterested in that, or seemingly uninterested. I think that's sort of the exciting task, is how to build groups in the congregation that truly are interested in these things, because I think that it's only seemingly uninterested in a lot of cases. But usually I would think we would have heard more frustration of this.
Mm-hmm. We have something very clear for us in the view. If we speak about social change, that the poor are the agents of the transformation.
And the poor are a majority in your country.
Yeah, they are a big majority.
Which is a difference with the U.S.
Yes.
Yeah.
Not for long. But, for example, the landless in Brazil, the number is more than 20 million families without land. Agriculture.
Who are in rural areas.
Rural
people, but without land.
Without land.
Mm-hmm.
And in this issue, the church is doing something. It's not like here, we cannot say that all the church is doing it, but we have a big concern about agrarian reform. That's the big issue now in this moment in Brazil. We are really a pity that we are not there. We would like to take part in this, because you know that last year we stopped 21 years of military dictatorship. And so since March last year, we have a civilian government, and all this civilian movement is growing, and the agrarian reform is now the big issue.
Mm-hmm.
And many pastors are helping the poor people, the landless, to organize themselves. And they are creating what we call acampamentos, some camps. They settle an area with many families, and they are there, and they have to be fed. And they want to have land to work. They don't want this land free. They want paid, but they just want to have the chance to have land and grow something for them and their family. And that's really a big issue. Because not just saying, let's make agrarian reform and it's all done.
Some fantasy which is happening, especially in South Brazil, is with the camps where landless and poor people camp, usually 500 to 1,000 families in one place. And is that when pastors get involved in the movement, they usually
carry their congregations with them.
They do?
And yeah, and the congregations usually are reactionary. They don't want to know about it. They say, oh, these are communists, you know, these dirty people. Because if they don't have land, it's because they don't work. These mm-hmm. people, you know, they are lazy. Mm-hmm. Poor and lazy, they're always... something interesting happening is that some of these camps are made close to Lutheran congregations, and the pastors go and visit and bring people from the congregation with them, and bring the people from the congregation, usually low middle class, to talk to these people. And these people return with, you know, oh, it's not what I thought it would be. You know, these people are nice. They are like me. They like to drink our chimarrão, which are Brazilian beer. You know, these people, they are people. And
they're human.
Yeah, and you know, the congregations have had their minds changed too.
Through direct involvement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just to detail, the camps, they happen during the night. In one day the land is bare, and nobody's there, and then the other day 500,000 families are there. Mm-hmm. And then they have to do something. Squatters. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Certainly a number of congregations here have, over the years, tried things like pairing. A suburban congregation will pair with an inner city poor congregation and do a number of exchanges and so forth. The same sort of humanization process goes on. People mm-hmm. begin to look at each other across class lines and across race lines and so on.
We will talk more about Brazil the next days.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we should have two nights. One, we were discussing, one is too late. We have so much to talk, because it's not so easy just say, oh, let's help the people to organize these camps, and then they have land, it's all okay. It's not much more change to have that we have to make.
It's a threat to somebody else's interest whenever that happens.
Oh, yeah.
Therefore, it's intensely political.
Yeah, and that's work. Much more easier in Brazil to make a change than here in the United States, because here the structure, the capitalist and materialist structure, is so strong and internalized in everybody that it's much more difficult to change something here in the United States than in our country. Much more.
And we have some people in our congregation, some real dedicated people in social ministries that I admire a lot, because they don't get discouraged easily. One idea they had and have carried out for 2 years now is, at Lenten time, there are two services, and in between services it's supper in the basement. And one table is set aside as the letter writing table. So you have a choice. You know, if you don't want to be involved, you don't have to sit at that table. But if you want to, every week there's an issue to write a letter about. Like Bread for the World, they'll read that article and say, okay, this is an issue, a specific issue that you need to write your legislator about. Here's how you write letters. Here's the addresses. We'll help you get it done. Because it's easy to say, I ought to write about that. But I've never written a letter before that I can not do it. So it's kind of a lonely table sometimes. But they did it again this year, and I really admire them.
That's a creative approach.
Yeah. How many congregations are active in the crosswalk the first Sunday in May? Washington State was the biggest one per capita, money level, and people level in the whole United States. And we're going to try to get all the Lutheran congregations that if they're not pledging something, they have to walk. But they can walk and pledge. We have almost all the kids walking.
For those who don't know, this is raising money for world hunger purposes, right?
Right?
Overseas primarily.
And Lutheran World Relief is one of the ones listed on the back.
As a beneficiary.
As a beneficiary of it. But the first Sunday in May, if you want to get involved with it, give me your name and your congregation name, and I can send you the information so you can get it from the director. 97% of the money goes to the people. Only 3% is in the paperwork. It's all done by volunteers. And I like old.
Anybody want to talk about conflict that comes as a result of mm-hmm. this sort of thing? You do, okay.
I'm thinking 2 miles, but I'll bring up the one is that
there's a woman in our congregation, specific, but she's extremely involved politically and has campaign manager for Judy Bosch's Minnesota senator, a few people like that. And she's terribly interested in that. And as she goes to church, she's just terribly interested in what happens within the congregation in terms of projects that might be involved, hunger shelf, that kind of stuff. Whenever we try to bring those two together to say, we as Lutherans need to be aware of political issues and be responsible then in our choices, and any discussion of politics, it's just, she gets angry and will walk out.
She's involved in it, but not in church. She doesn't want that dealt with in church, yeah.
The kind of split, I think, somewhere along the line that Lutherans have created out of Luther's church-state, two-kingdom model, that those two are to be separate and there the twain shall meet, which we can understand, but how do you deal with that other than that church?
Well, I frankly, folks, find some hope from the new religious right. At least they're saying the faith has something to do with the public realm. They're saying that with a vengeance. I mean, the moral majority of those people have suddenly discovered what I think Lutherans many times still have to discover, that the faith always has implications for politics.
But you're hoping that that will create those who don't agree with the new right to respond in an opposite rather than be totally repulsive.
Yeah, I don't like the agenda of the new right. I disagree with where they are on many, if not all, of the issues they think are important. But I agree with them at that one point, that the faith always must have impact on my politics.
But I hear a lot of people being repulsed, not by, just by their issues, but that they would take that into the public realm.
Yeah, including a lot of Lutherans are offended by that. And that, I think, is a Lutheran blind spot. And it does come out of what we were how we were shaped.
Bob, you were trying to jump in.
Well, yeah, earlier I was going to comment about Holden Wicker involvement in advocacy letter writing. That was Lutheran already. I mean, that the congregation does. And Monday evenings here, for those who haven't been up in the winter, you get a bowl of rice and a glass of water. Or half, and I don't mean on the same evening or menu, I mean on a different Monday evening, you may include have half a baked potato and a glass of water. I guess you can still eat coffee. But before the meal, everybody sits down and someone makes a presentation about some issue, some concern. They present some information, and we have our meal. And then there's letter writing materials provided, sometimes a form letter. You know, all you need to do is sign it and then get the address of your senator, representative, whomever. Some weeks it's about farming and land concerns, other weeks it's world hunger. One week was the Hopi Navajo issue. You know, each week's a different issue, and it's advocacy letter writing. That's involvement in social change. Sometimes you get some good feelings about it, such as the report anyway on the sentencing of the sanctuary workers was that the very unexpected light sentencing or
suspended sentence.
The sentences is being attributed to a massive letter writing campaign. That Judge Carroll received thousands of letters, including letters from senators, and senators whom I imagine received letters from people concerned. So sometimes there appears to be some payoff. Sometimes you get a letter back from the representative or senator that sent a letter to, and it'll be in the newspaper that there's an overwhelming number of letters supporting this side of an issue, and yet the person votes the other side, and they send back form letters saying, well, I know I got overwhelming urging me to vote this way, but I voted my conscience, and it's the way the president wanted me to vote. Mm. And at that point, it's kind of frustrating to do, well, you know, what the heck.
I see a hand upstairs.
In our Lutheran congregation, we have something that is similar to what you were just talking about. We have a social concerns committee, and then we have a peace and justice task force that is a task force to the social concerns committee. And we meet on a fairly regular basis, and we will discuss current issues and then write letters also. That's one of the things that we do. We are involved with the crosswalk, and we are a covenant church with Red for the World. And our congregation, rather reluctantly, but it did do it, the church council voted to be in support of the local congregation, a Roman Catholic congregation, that is providing sanctuary to South Sudan refugees. This is in Spokane.
What does that mean to be in support of them?
That means that we give monthly money.
Mm-hmm.
That means that we pray for the people. That means that there are people in the congregation who go and provide transportation if transportation is needed. There are members of the congregation who have signed a covenant agreement with the people of St. Anne's, who say that if the people who are on trial are convicted, then they are also guilty.
And the decision was made by the church council.
The decision by the church council was to provide the emotional support and the money.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And there are the members of Zion who are willing to step out and take some risks too. And there have been times when members of the congregation have spoken on television with Zion's name under them, and then the people in the congregation have said, "Ooh, saw you on television," and the question was asked, "Well, how did you feel about that?" We were proud.
Oh, that's a positive story. I don't know if it would happen that way in every congregation.
Spokane is a very conservative city. I'm happy for it to happen there. But it took a lot of work.
Yeah. So the preparatory work was done well, you're saying.
I'm curious. Do you think that after all this, that your congregation would largely, in a majority, vote to change American policy toward El Salvador and refugees if it came to some sort of voting action?
I don't know.
I think that's one of the interesting little things that is related to your circle here. And that's that we're very willing to put our billfold into social service issues. And as you were pointing out, fund and sort of tacitly support a top-level federal or state position Lutheran body that might have some sort of political position on issues. But we are interestingly split personality on this, that we might very well put money in the offering plate for that. But on the next vote that comes up, certainly vote our pocketbooks in a bigger way, in which the social change issue may actually hurt our personal life. Therefore, when it comes down to voting it, we won't do it. I guess this drawing out is a question for argument and to get this thing. How many people think that the reason that Lutherans are so bad at social change is that Lutherans are well placed economically, mostly?
We have a stake in the order as it is established.
Right.
As
it is. Since we're doing well,
yes.
We don't really want to change things socially.
Some who haven't gotten in yet. Yeah.
Yeah, that brings up a point I wanted to mention, that as a past in Lutheran congregation working with the social ministry committee, my role as a pastor is to comfort the afflicted, and we do that well, but to afflict the comfortable.
Yes.
It's not easy to do.
Does that translate? You know what he's saying.
Sometimes we're called to do that, and that's risky business. And it's difficult to do that when you're serving the congregation and they...
That is comfortable.
Yeah, yeah, right.
For the most part. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the challenge of ministry, is to have that prophetic edge as well as the pastoral and caring for the needs and the concerns of the congregation, but to also be the prophet in the congregation, which isn't very popular. You know, look at how the prophets...
Prophets never are. Prophets never have a majority with them, do they?
But I think that's our challenge. I know Bishop Erdahl challenged us to do that at our last gathering of pastors in our conference. He said, you know, we simply have to get about the business and be more prophetic in our ministry and bringing up the issues that are of concern to people of faith. It's risky, but we need to do it. I think it's been a problem of the clergy as well, not being willing to take those kind of risks. Mm-hmm.
Does it happen to you that Lutheran pastors are expelled sometimes from congregations because of political involvement? Does it happen?
Cliff, does it happen?
Pennsylvania?
Well, yeah, that's an outstanding example of where it did happen, but I guess I sometimes long to see pastors get in trouble for things like that. You know, they get in trouble for other things.
And can be asked to leave. Congregations in our system can ask them to leave, but he's saying it doesn't happen very often for those reasons.
No.
Bob?
Yeah, I want to make a comment about your question that had to do with preaching. Because I think it ties in with the prophetic, and gives me a chance to say what I wasn't asked to say last night in sermon. I didn't get close to the microphone. You know, what would I tell Barbara to do?
Oh yeah, let's hear that, Barbara. You're listening.
Better late than never.
Preach the text. I don't think I have to be prophetic. I think I've preached the text to the text already here. Mm-hmm. There isn't any text Scripture that isn't a polemical text. Every text exposes, if we let it, vested interests. So I don't know that we need so much to preach ethical outcomes, but with imagination, preach what's in the text and let the text be proclaimed. And it's incredible what it would empower congregations to do.
I think that's good, but I also recall that I grew up for many, many years, probably until I was in my 20s, never knowing that the Magnificat had anything to do with the poor, the really poor. It had to do with the spiritually poor. It was spiritualized, because that's the kind of preaching I heard.
Yeah.
And so there's preaching, and then there's preaching.
Well, the exciting thing that's going on in biblical studies currently is a sociological analysis. And so people like Robert Wilson in the Old Testament with the prophets and guarantees and Tyson and Corinthians and Robert Coates with First Peter and Melina. The books that some of them will be used here this summer. A reading of the text with the socio-economic political context of the text. Attention being given to that, and then hearing the text in new ways.
Yeah, and that's increasingly the way pastors are being trained, but it will be a new hearing for many of our people, because they haven't heard that kind of preaching before in traditional middle-class Lutheran settings.
But as long as it's a preaching of the text, then they don't need to argue with me and my ideology.
Yeah.
With all arguing with the text, or let the text argue with us.
That may be the best thing we have going for us, that there is still a deep respect among Lutheran people in this country, and I think other countries as well, for the Bible. And if you can show that it's in the Bible, they'll at least give it a hearing.
But people have a tendency to say that's in by interpretation. And the woman that I was speaking of, when the pastor was saying in a sermon that we need to be aware of what legislation is going on in Minnesota, and he was choosing to give it at that point. And it was very important to that text for the day. She got very, very edgy about that. And my mother heard her huffing and puffing behind her in the choir. And I agree with you. I think that's important. I get sort of diarrhea from the thought of it when I get up to preach. But there's also a sense of hammering people with it. And I know pastors who want to hammer people from the pulpit and not use education as in discussion. You can't discuss with the pastor, excuse me, I don't agree with what you're saying. I'm questioning your interpretation.
It, because the sermon mode is monologue, it's not dialogue.
Well, you get a pulpit sometimes on the floor, but it's two people, not apologies.
I think Elmer showed us a different way of doing it last night.
Yeah.
One or two more comments.
Getting back to the economic issue, what did you think of one? The other reason that people are willing to say, let's let the Lutheran body do this in regard to social issues is because, unlike tax dollars that you don't have any control over, you can simply decrease your pledge that year or not come through with your pledge that year, and if you don't like something, you can just sort of relax on it and say, well, that's fine, I'll give that money, more money to the church. So that really what we're getting down to here is, when you talk about social change issues, are economic issues, and we like to kind of dodge that, but as Bill was talking about afflicting the comfortable, it really is an economic issue. We have to get to the point somehow in church where faith means more than economic comfort.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a major hurdle, because that's the reason why you'll go down and vote the next day for something that's good for you, whereas the day before you supported the church body in doing something that, in its long-range effect, will probably hurt you, but it'll never happen, because you can always withhold your money if you need to.
Our little visitors must be upstairs.
Fine. The mouse must have just run up the clock, which probably means that we're out of time, I think. We do need to call, I think, a formal halt to this, because we're already over time. Go ahead, Carl. One last
suggestion: why we don't continue tomorrow and start with the Bible, as you said. Start with studying a Bible text and see how the Bible studies and understands the society, the structure of the society of their time, his or her time. And then we can have some apps.
Okay, let's develop that idea afterwards tonight rather than doing it in the whole group, okay? Thank you all. One of the interesting things about tonight, it seems to me, was the beginning of a kind of, to use it awfully, ridiculously overused term, networking here of the notions that different congregations are engaged in. And I really hope that's something that continues over the week, that people continue to exchange information and data on how your congregations are doing this.